This is Jason Warburg, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
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 You're listening to Rock is Lit with Christy Halberg. Rock on, Christy.
Is Lit.
Hey, Lit listeners. Thanks for tuning in to Rock is Lit, the first and still only podcast devoted to rock novels, and also the 2024 American Writing Awards Podcast of the Year in the categories of music and arts. Rock is Lit is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Hey, I'm John Stewart, and you're listening to the Pantheon Network.
Rock is Lit is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Christy Alexander Halberg, author of my own rock novel, Searching for Jimmy Page. Special shout out to this semester's Rock is Lit interns, production intern Cater Jones, and social media intern Jenna Rudolph. Find out more about me and Rock is Lit on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Christy Halberg. Visit my website at ChristyAlexanderHalberg.com. And for goodness sakes, subscribe, comment, leave a 5-star rating and all that good stuff on your podcast platform of choice. Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, the show starts in 3, 2, 1.
I'm excited to welcome Jason Warburg back to Rock is Lit. Jason first appeared on the podcast in episode 33 to discuss the first novel in his Tim Green series, Believe in Me. He returned for episode 40 when we talked about the second novel in the series, Never Break the Chain. And now he's here to celebrate the publication of his third Tim Green novel, Home Was a Dream. The son of a writer and an architect, Jason Warburg was building worlds in his imagination before he learned to ride a bike. Obsessed with music in his teens and politics in his 20s, he would eventually write both fiction and nonfiction exploring these realms. His books include the Tim Green series, his memoir, The Remembering, Reflections on Love, Art, Faith, Heroes, Grief, and Baseball, and My Heart Sings the Harmony, a collection of his album and concert reviews, artist interviews, and essays. He is also the longtime editor of music review site, The Daily Vault. In Jason's third Tim Green novel, Home Was a Dream, themes of Jewish heritage, identity, and the haunting legacy of the Holocaust intertwine with the healing power of music. During our discussion, Jason shares insights into his personal connection to Jewish culture and history, revealing how these influences shape the characters' journeys in the novel. Through the lens of characters grappling with their Jewish identity, Jason explores the profound repercussions of the Holocaust on a generation haunted by loss and trauma. Against this backdrop, music emerges as a potent force, offering solace and connection amidst the turmoil. Home Was a Dream is a profound examination of fathers and sons, forgiveness and redemption, and a moving testament to the resiliency of the human spirit. Before we begin our discussion, have a listen to an excerpt of the novel. Here's Jason Warburg reading the prologue of Home Was a Dream.
We think we know our parents, but we're wrong. We imagine that spending our childhood with them gives us a window into their hearts and minds. And this is true up to a point, but it's also true that we're missing more information than we possess. By the time we arrive, we've already missed out on the entire span of years that shaped and molded them into the person we then observe through the eyes of a child. The time we do spend in close contact with them, 2 decades, give or take, then plays out within the infinitely distorting crucible of parent and child. To us, our mothers and fathers were always adults, always parents, always in a position of responsibility and authority. The parents we construct in our minds are like avatars, exaggerated cartoon figures whose world does not obey the normal laws of physics. We hear about their lives prior to our birth, mostly in stories they tell, stories that are inevitably refracted through the trapdoors of memory, redacted for an underaged audience, and colored by the demands of ego. Our real parents, those life-sized, flesh-and-blood, inevitably flawed human beings, are nearly invisible to us as children, hidden behind an infinite series of kabuki masks, inside an endless sequence of Russian nesting dolls. They are in many respects strangers, warm and familiar ones if we're lucky, but strangers all the same. My name is Tim Green. 2 years ago, my father died, the only parent I had ever known, and losing him set me adrift like a satellite losing orbit and spinning out into the void. I spent most of my 28th year ducking and covering while the five stages of grief pummeled me black and blue. In time, I managed to let go, only to transfer a lot of that energy into searching for my mother, a woman who was little more than a rumor to me until after my father had passed. When I found her, she truly was a stranger, albeit one who managed to fill in a few of my blanks before disappearing again. Even now, so many of those blanks remain unfilled. As a child, for better or for worse, my father was everything to me, sun, moon, and stars. But did I truly know him? I don't see how I could say that I did when I still can't understand how he came to the most important decision of, I was about to say his life, but I can't even really say that for sure. What I know is that the decision he made that day was the most important one of my life. When I was 2 months old, my mother knocked on the door of my father's apartment and thrust me into his arms. Before he opened the door, he hadn't known I existed. 2 days later, he took me in and gave me the only home I would ever know. Keep in mind, this was November 1980, and my dad, Bernie Green, was 27 and single, a writer for a national music magazine whose job kept him out late at concerts. He'd met my mother at one the previous New Year's Eve, and traveling around the western U.S. for days at a time. If he'd started the Northern California Single Dad Music Writers Club, he might have been the only member. I've wondered so many times what went through his mind in that moment when he opened his front door to find me waiting in my mother's arms. We had tiptoed around the subject a few times, but he would always brush it off like it was nothing, like it was simply expected that he would take me in, leaving me to wonder again and again. Once he got past the initial shock, once he processed the three-dimensional reality of the baby being held out to him, his child, his son, by a woman he barely knew. How did he get from there to saying yes? Yes, I want to take this carefree nomad's life I've been living, tear it down to the studs, and start over, rebuilding it around a tiny, helpless human being for whom I have total responsibility. Fatherhood was thrust on him, yes, but it was also a choice he made. I'm honestly not sure I could have made the same one. I'm not proud of that, but it's true. And maybe a few times over the years I've resented Dad a little bit for that, that degree of selflessness and certainty that still feels out of my grasp. But mostly I'm just curious. What was it about his life up to that point that compelled him to say yes? Was I an obligation he couldn't refuse? A dream he'd thought still lay in the future? Or something else entirely? I've asked myself these questions before, but never with the kind of urgency they carry today. I don't just want to understand what Dad was thinking then. I need to. Dad has been gone for almost 2 years now, and I'm almost done packing up the house I grew up in to rent it out while my fiancé Terry Valenzuela and I drive half the length of California to a Los Angeles apartment to be closer to my half-siblings, my wayward mother's other children. After 20 years as best friends, last year, Terry and I took the leap into a romantic relationship, and then 2 months ago got engaged, on a whim, Saturday morning pillow talk that had taken a turn. This both delighted and terrified me. delighted because I've loved Terry almost as long as I've known her. And when we finally became partners in every sense of that charged word, it had felt so right. But now we were telling people we were engaged and moving 500 miles to start a new life in a new city together. And it was all starting to feel very real, very quickly. And that drew a neon yellow highlighter over the questions we conveniently shoved off to one side of our eager embrace. Number one, underlined in bold, do I want to have children? I knew Terry wanted kids, and that made me want them. But I couldn't be sure, not yet. And that clanging alarm of uncertainty brought me back again and again to that moment when 27-year-old Bernie Green had opened his door to find me waiting on the other side. What was it in his life up to that point that had compelled him to say yes to me, to fatherhood, to a new life that he couldn't have seen rushing toward him just hours before? How did he know? And how will I?
Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? You're only dancing on this earth for a short while. And though your dreams may toss and turn you now, they will vanish away like your daddy's best jeans, denim blue, fading up to the sky. And though you want them to last forever, you know we never will. You know we never will. And the patches make the goodbye.
This is Kelly McNeil, and this is Rock is Lit.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Hello again, Jason.
Hi, Christy. It's great to be back.
This is your third time on Rock is Lit, which means you win the prize for most guest appearances on the podcast so far.
I'm not sure how I feel about that, other than that I'd better get back to writing quickly.
Well, there you go. We can talk later in the episode about what you're working on now, but you're here today to talk about your brand new novel, the third in your Tim Green series called Home Was a Dream, out now. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, since we've already talked at length about the first two Tim Green novels in episodes 33 and 40,
We're going to focus our discussion in this episode on Home Was a Dream. But in case listeners need a refresher on the series in general, here's the Rock is Lit rundown. The first installment, Believe in Me, follows young campaign operative Tim Green, who is grieving the recent passing of his music journalist father, the only parent he's ever known. After his career in politics abruptly ends, Tim encounters the charismatic rock star Jordan Lee, leading to a whirlwind adventure across the United States as they pursue their dreams amidst the backdrop of the music industry. The novel is a story about heroes and how we create and relate to them, but it's also about dealing with loss and grief. In the second installment, Never Break the Chain, Tim embarks on a quest to find his long-lost mother while navigating the turbulent world of the Los Angeles rock and roll scene. Bonding with the teenage son of his new boss, Tim delves into the history of a struggling arena rock band, Empire, as he unravels his own family's story. The question at the heart of this novel is, what is family? The third novel in the series, Home Was a Dream, delves into the intricacies of family dynamics and the intergenerational impact of trauma. As Tim confronts the legacy of his paternal grandfather's tragic experiences during the Holocaust, the novel explores themes of resilience, forgiveness, and the enduring power of music, which connects the three generations of Green men. Jason, I think it's fairly evident from that overview of the series that you bit off a lot in this last book. It's much broader in terms of subject matter and historical periods. And I know from reading a recent blog post of yours that writing about the Holocaust was really daunting for you. So why did you feel compelled to do it?
Well, I went down the trail of trying to write a story about Bernie, Tim's father. And I considered what that story would look like and what I would want to explore about Bernie's life. I knew he was a music journalist who was incredibly passionate about rock and roll. I knew that he was born in 1953, so that placed him right in the heart of the boomer generation. And that led me to thinking, well, a lot of people in that generation got into rock and roll and very absorbed in the music culture as a way of rebelling. And so then, as I continued this sort of self-interrogation, I thought, okay, well, what was he rebelling against? Maybe it's a cliche, but it's certainly one that I feel like is fertile ground. Fathers and sons. There's a long history of literature there. So I figured, okay, Bernie has a difficult relationship with his father. What's that about? Continued down that trail of logic. And I considered what his father's age would be. If Bernie was born in 1953, then, well, his father was probably a teenager during World War II. Okay, well, maybe it was an experience during World War II that affected him in such a way that he was a particularly difficult person for Bernie to relate to. And then the whole frame came together as I thought about the fact that Tim is the son of a Jewish family who does not practice Judaism, nor did his father, but his father's sister, his aunt, is married to a rabbi and very involved in faith as part of her life. And so it was clear there was some sort of dichotomy going on there where part of the family was involved in Judaism and part of it wasn't, which was an interesting thing to explore. But it also hit me right away that, okay, Bernie's father was a Jewish teenager during World War II. And where you go with that almost feels obvious, but also felt, yes, incredibly daunting. That's the right word.
When you realize, I think I'm going to have this character be involved in the Holocaust in some way, shape, or form, did you feel like you were well-versed in that history, or were you just thinking, oh my God, I don't want to do this?
I went back and forth, honestly. I spent a long time questioning whether it was a path I wanted to go down, whether it was a path I could go down. I felt a lot of hesitation just because in my own life, I'm the son of a Jewish father and an Episcopalian mother, and I was raised by my mother. So a lot of my experience of Jewish culture and faith tradition is taken from books and movies. certainly I have a lot of friends, and I've tried to explore and absorb what I can through those conversations and opportunities to learn more about Judaism. But going there in a book and having my characters go through this incredibly traumatic event was a difficult thing for me to make the decision to tackle. There are a number of factors in my decision to go down that road. But one of the main things was realizing that Holocaust stories need to be told. The generation of survivors is passing into history as we speak right now. And so I think it's incumbent on people who tell stories, who feel moved to tell stories about that period of history, to do that and to keep that history alive in people's consciousness. I started writing the story, and I started out with Tim in the first person. He's always been my narrator of my stories. And then I moved into a sequence where we were talking about Bernie as a child and a teenager and his relationship with his family. And then I moved into the first section where we meet his father, Max, as a boy and start learning about his life. And I was moving that family towards going to a concentration camp. And I knew that was where that chapter was going to end. And at a certain point in that chapter, I just stopped. I realized that in order to go any further and to do it with the kind of authenticity that was really important to me to get right, I needed to know more and I needed to do more research. So I actually stopped working on the writing part of the book for several months. And in that period, I did a lot of research into the particular camp that I identified that I wanted to have be part of the story, which is the one concentration camp that I've ever been to as a tourist called Terezin. And it's an hour or so north of Prague in the former Czechoslovakia. There are several authoritative books about that particular camp, which was very unique in that it was kind of a show camp that the Nazis used in their propaganda to prove that they weren't mistreating all the people that they were putting into camps. But it was an old kind of decrepit fortress left around from the Austro-Hungarian Empire that was repurposed as a prison. And there is an authoritative survivor's memoir by H.G. Adler that was very helpful. It was almost too authoritative. There were so many details that you could get lost in them, and I had to pick and choose what felt relevant to the story and the characters. There's also a more recent scholarly book about Terezin, and a third book that I found very useful, which was specifically about music in Terezin. And that was the other point at which I realized this would work as a setting for a part of a Tim Green story. Because one of the unique things about Terezin was that the prisoners were able to have a little bit of a cultural life. There were a few kind of leftover, not very good shape instruments available to them. And there were a number of musicians and artists and people with a great appreciation for art and culture who were being held captive there. And one of the ways that they got through one of their survival mechanisms day to day was to create art and create music. Mm-hmm. And so that became part of the story inevitably. That was, I think, another reason that at a certain point I said, okay, this is going to work. These pieces do fit together.
You know, that part of the book was fascinating to me because I didn't know if you had just made up the bit in Terezin where the prisoners actually get to attend concerts on occasion, and there are piano lessons that some of the characters actually take, I had no idea that that was actually going on in a concentration camp. So I learned a lot from reading your book.
I'm glad. And that is another reason that I felt like it would work, was because the camp was so unique. And before I visited it, I knew very little about it. I'm not sure I'd even ever heard of it before we decided we were going on that tour and learned about the places we'd be going. But it was fascinating and I think, you know, something worth exploring and knowing about.
You also mentioned Dresden, Auschwitz, Dachau, and some of the things that went on in the concentration camps that were so horrific. One of the things is that typhus ran rampant through these camps, and one of the characters contracts that and passes away. And there's the issue of all of the rapes that took place in these camps. And what do you do if you get pregnant? You brought that up. What challenges did you face in portraying these historical contexts so authentically?
I think the number one challenge was just the one that I kind of set for myself, which was that if I was going to go there, if I was going to set this piece of the story in the Holocaust, I wanted it to be as historically accurate as I could make it within a fictional context. The main characters who are involved in those chapters are fictional, but there are a few real people who they interact with. Those conversations obviously are completely fictional, but the research informed them a lot in terms of what those people were like, what the camp life was like. And it was really, I don't know what the right word is, it was fulfilling to feel like I could bring some of that history to life and maybe present it in a way that, as you say, you found both intriguing and educational. So I'm really glad to hear that, and that's great.
In that same blog post that I mentioned a minute ago, you wrote that you struggled with imposter syndrome. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, as I said, my Jewish background, such as it is pretty limited. And so as I was thinking about this story, and even while I was doing the research, I was questioning whether I was the right person to be telling it. Where I ultimately came back to, once I had done enough research so that I felt like I could write credibly about it, and at least with some semblance of historical accuracy, was just that I'm a storyteller. This is my job. This is what I do. And so this is an important story to tell, and I'll tell it as well as I can, and others can be the judge of how accurate it is. It's not a history book. It's a novel. It's a story.
Yeah.
But I tried to honor the experience of the people who were in Terezin and in the Holocaust.
Do you think in writing the book that it affected, changed your relationship with your own Jewish heritage?
Yeah, I do. I do. I feel a lasting, deep affinity there. I can't say that I have religious faith that could be described as such, but I feel a strong connection to my Jewish roots. And to some degree, I always have, just in terms of family and family ties. But I feel a stronger connection now to the longer and broader story of Jewish history in the world.
And there's so much going on that's just horrible right now involving Israel and Gaza. And so I couldn't help but wonder, you had to have either been finished with the book or in the final editing stages when the October 7, 2023 Hamas-led attack on that open-air music festival in Israel happened. And, you know, to be working on a book of this nature with that happening and then all of the terrible repercussions to that attack, I wondered, how was he thinking about his Jewish heritage at this point? So you kind of answered my question.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was working on the editing of the book at that point, and I'm thinking about a particular line that I added to the book very late in the process, which reflects on revenge. and a character reflects on the fact that revenge felt good just in that moment. And then forever after, there was just a lot of regret and a recognition that in carrying out revenge, that character put themselves on the same level as the person who had harmed them.
Hmm.
A lot was channeled into that scene.
Like you, who grew up not really identifying as Jewish, the characters Tim, Bernie, and Max all grapple with the issue of identity in general and with their Jewish identity as well. Here's a quote from a section focused on Max about this. Like the rest of his family, he had a strange relationship with his own identity. He knew his family were Jews by technicality, but he had never felt anything but Czech. So talk to me a little bit about the struggle with identity, particularly Jewish identity, these characters are dealing with and how that manifests in the novel.
Yeah, I think one of the things for Max is that he's going through this experience where his family is being oppressed. His father loses his job. They have to flee the village where they've been living his whole life. And yet his parents at their marriage had declared themselves without religious confession. They don't go to synagogue. But that doesn't matter. To the Nazis, they're Jews. It is, for the Nazis, it's strictly a racial category. And it doesn't matter what they believe. And I think that only adds to Max's sense of just bafflement at why this is happening to him and his family. But each of them grapples with this in different ways. In Bernie's childhood, his father, Max, is not particularly observant. But his mother does make an effort to try to keep some of the traditions alive, celebrating Hanukkah and things like that. But he's an independent spirit. And he wants to strike out in the world and forge his own identity. And that's just a really fundamental piece of his character. And there's kind of a tension between him and his sister, Ruth, because she is more traditional. She is more of a person who wants to please her parents and to preserve tradition. And she actually ends up marrying a rabbi and her faith really blossoms. In the context of that relationship. So I was interested in sort of exploring those different paths and where it took those characters. And then, you know, Tim was Bernie's son. So again, his experience was he knew he had Jewish roots, but he had no experience of practicing Judaism in his home.
Well, you know, like you were saying earlier about it not mattering to the Nazis whether or not you were a practicing Jew, it was a racial matter for them. It struck me as I was reading how awful it would be to be persecuted for something that's been ascribed to you rather than something about yourself that you chose or at least claim as part of your identity. And still related to the idea of who am I that you explore in the story. You write in the section where Max and his family are waiting to board a train for Terezin that all the Jewish people there at the depot are forced to wear a number. So suddenly, they've lost their humanity. Not only are they labeled as Jews, but now they're just a number. That aspect of the book, questions of identity, the exploration of the character's Jewish heritage, is really interesting and powerful.
Well, thank you. And those details all grew out of that research. I mean, all of those things are well documented. You know, there's tension that I went through in telling the story of how many of those details to include, because a lot of them have been used in Holocaust stories and movies that people are familiar with. but they're real. They're historically accurate. And again, I think it's important to continue to help people understand what happened, how it happened, and the incredible impact it had, not just on the people who were killed, but on the people who survived and their families.
The preface of Home Was a Dream begins with the line, "We think we know our parents, but we're wrong." How does that idea play out in the narrative?
That is really a key piece of the narrative. And it's something that, you know, on reflection, I realized grew out of a lot of the work and the writing I was doing before I started writing this book. Because my parents passed away in 2018 and 2019. And during the pandemic, as everyone else was baking bread and cleaning out their closets, I was going through all of my parents' photos and papers and correspondence that they'd saved. And what was remarkable was how much I was still learning about both my mother and my father, people I'd known my entire life. And reflecting on that, I thought about how we all assume that we know our parents really well. But the fact is that we only met them when they were already responsible adults in the process of becoming parents. We weren't present for any of the really formative experiences of their lives that created the people that we know.
Did you come across anything that you wish you hadn't?
You know, there were certainly a few things that surprised me a little or that weren't particularly easy to read. But I think in general, I'm a person who would rather know than not know. And I didn't find anything that was terrible. It was just human beings acting like human beings. It's what we do.
I go back and forth about how much I do want to know about my parents as people. My mother died in 2003. That's an interesting question. How much do you really want to know? And Bernie and Tim are not given that option, really. Bernie doesn't know anything about his father's history until his father becomes quite ill. Tim really doesn't know anything about his mother, other than very, very slim details about how his father met his mother. And he doesn't know anything about his grandfather at all. Bernie would never talk about it. So these two people were not really given a chance of making up their minds about whether or not they even wanted to know details of their parents' history.
Yeah, it's true. And in fact, that presented a real challenge in terms of the narrative structure of the story, because I knew that I wanted to tell a story about Bernie and how he had grown up. And then that led me down the path to talking about Max and how he had grown up. But the narrative of the first two novels is that Tim is the first person narrator. You're inside his head. You're seeing the world through his eyes. And I didn't want to abandon that. So I had to figure out a way to tell a story through Tim's eyes about two characters who are not alive in his present.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a fun little puzzle. And the solution was Bernie's sister, his Aunt Ruth, who had been a minor character in the first two stories and had a couple of appearances. But she was a little bit of a cipher. She was very reserved, stoic personality. And you didn't really know anything about her other than that she had sort of a classic older sibling relationship with Bernie, where she was a little bit disapproving, but also very affectionate and supportive and had helped him with Tim when Tim came into his life.
Yeah.
But it became clear that Ruth was going to be the linchpin of this story. because she was the source who could give Tim the information that he was looking for about his father. And then at a certain point, when Ruth realizes that Bernie has never told Tim about his grandfather, she realizes that it's on her to tell that story too.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the structure because it is quite different. All we ever get is first person point of view in those first two books from Tim's perspective. So I really enjoyed getting that information. I realize it's coming from Ruth, but you still get a different perspective on Bernie. In the second book, there's an incredible description of a photograph of Tim's mother taken the night that Bernie first meets Tim's mother. In this book, you get Bernie's perspective on when he met Tim's mother, which was at a Bob Seger concert, New Year's Eve, 1979. And it's so interesting to put those two together from the two books and see how they match up.
Well, one of the first things I did when I had the narrative structure in mind and sort of knew the story I wanted to tell, I went back and pulled out all of the references in the first two books to Bernie and his interactions with other people in his life, because having stumbled into writing a series, I knew that one of the biggest mistakes I could potentially make was to contradict something that I said in the first two books. And so that became sort of a little homework assignment. But then it was fun looking at things like brief references to the scene you just described at the Bob Seger concert and thinking, okay, those are the parameters I have to work with. Like, I can't really color outside of those lines, but I can put a lot more detail in than is in the first books and in those brief references. And it was almost like blowing up a photograph or something. You get this sort of fleeting small glimpse of something, and then you get the full-bodied version just sort of evolving naturally out of the narrative.
Working on a night move, trying to make some front page driving news. Working on a night move in the summertime.
This is Franz Nicolai, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
In Never Break the Chain, the central question of what is family is introduced, and Home Was a Dream continues to explore that question. Let's talk a little bit about family and what family means to the Green Men.
Yeah. Tim, in the first book, is really trying to find a new family because the only parent he's ever known is his father, and he's an only child. He has somewhat of a relationship with Ruth and her kids, but they haven't been a huge part of his life. And so he's looking for those family ties, and part of his experience of kind of tripping and falling into this world of rock and roll and meeting Jordan Lee is discovering a new kind of family, the road family of a rock band. And that gets to feel almost like home to him pretty quickly. But then, of course, at a certain point, he gets curious about his mother, and then he goes down that path and Never Break the Chain. And I think in learning more about her and that history and her relationship with his father helps him to sort of be a little more grounded and feel a little more solid in his relationship with Terry, his girlfriend, who he sort of realizes about three quarters of the way through, believing me, oh yeah, I'm in love with her. I just realized that. But his desire for family, I think it's just it's a basic human urge. And I think one of the things that was interesting to explore in Home Was a Dream was how different families can look and what that means to people.
That's really what I was getting at, that the whole idea of the biological family versus the chosen family. And when you're in a situation like Max was, where his family is split up. They're in a concentration camp, but he's not with them. And so he has to create another family, another kind of family, and it's the boys in the barracks.
Yeah, that was one of the really compelling pieces that I picked up in doing research about Terezin, was that families were separated immediately as they were registered into the camp. And a boy of Max's age would have been sent to the boys' home, where all of the kids up to age, I think they had two sets where the younger kids under about 10 were in one particular barracks, and from about 11 to 16 were in another barracks. And you can just imagine a room full of 30, 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old boys cut off from the rest of their family. There was always a room elder who was someone a little bit older who was sort of in charge of keeping something approaching order. If you can imagine that with 30, 14-year-olds in a relatively small space, it's just an extreme situation where really the only thing you can do is try to find those personal connections with the people who you are around you and are experiencing the same things that you are. And that was, for me, a really powerful piece of the story, was just exploring how Max's relationships blossomed with those people and they became his substitute intentional family.
Right. And then there's Bernie, who finds community and a family of sort in writing about music and going to concerts. And he says at one point, you know, when you go to a concert, you already have one thing in common with everybody in the room. Everybody's there to listen to this music. So that sort of became kind of a substitute family for him, because he didn't get along very well with his father. Biological family was difficult for him.
Yeah. And by the time he's finished with college, he's estranged from his father and doesn't go home often and sort of drifts in and out of a close connection with Ruth. And the rock and roll scene really does become his family. And so something that started out as a form of rebellion becomes his new community. And his best friends are the people he works with and the people he sees at shows. And even, I think maybe even later in that same paragraph you were just referring to, he mentions how the girls he goes out with are all people he meets at shows.
Right.
That's where he socializes. That is really his whole life.
Children play in the park. They don't know I'm alone in the dark. Even though time and time again I see your face smiling inside, I'm so happy that you love me. Oh, yeah. Life is lovely, oh, when you're near me.
Shifting gears a little bit, Max has some pretty harsh things to say about America and how America treats immigrants. Here's a quote from the first part of the novel, in which he's on a tear about this. Quote, people in this country work so hard at convincing themselves that they're so much better than those terrible Nazis. And then the Mexicans come and pick all our food and they treat them like dirt under their fingernails, like animals. Better than the Nazis, ha. The Americans think they are Superman, the heroes of the world. That's how it begins, the madness, with believing they are better than other people. If Hitler had been born here, it would have been Europe trying to save the world from the fascists. End quote. It sounds like the book is making quite an indictment on American exceptionalism.
Well, there's two things going on there. One is that this is the first time you really see Max blow his top. And it's a key part of establishing that he has a big temper and a lot of anger, and that he can be very silent and contained and then erupt almost without warning. And that's a key part of showing what Bernie's dealing with growing up in that household. But it also, I think, reflected a little bit of an immigrant's perspective coming in and seeing how America saw itself, particularly in that period of time in the early 60s, versus how someone who had grown up in another country might come in and view it, especially someone who had been a victim of prejudice. And, you know, if there's a little bit of the author's editorial voice leaking through between the lines, I can't really help that.
All right. So, Jason, I seem to recall you mentioning in a previous interview that you have a hard time choosing titles for your books. So how did you come up with Home Was a Dream?
I had, once again, a significant amount of struggle on coming up with a title. But I did something that I've done with each of the previous books, because I am a complete music junkie and also someone who collects quotes and someone who loves lyric sheets and liner notes. I spent a lot of time, as I was listening or as I was looking at liner notes, looking for potential lyric quotes that might fit. And both of the first two books, the titles are quotes from lyrics from reasonably notable songs, certainly memorable songs. And so I was looking for something that sort of fit that profile again. And as often happens with different kinds of inspiration, I wasn't actually looking in the moment that I found it. I was just listening to one of my favorite albums, which is Jason Isbell's Southeastern. I had been thinking about the fact that both Bernie and Max are really looking for some place to call home. And I tie that in very much with the idea of family, but they both have this strong sense of dislocation.
Yeah.
Max has been uprooted from where he grew up, and Bernie has run away from where he grew up. And they're both, as the story unfolds, looking for a place that feels like home. And Tim is, to a certain extent, too. He's trying to understand what his adult life is going to be like, and what kind of family he's going to have. And I think he feels the need to understand the family that he already has before he creates one of his own. But I was listening to the first song on Southeastern, Cover Me Up, and there is, I think it's Isbell's best song. I think a lot of people feel that way. And I think the second verse is one of the great verses of the 21st century. And I won't read the whole thing to you, but the key line is, "But home was a dream that I'd never seen till you came along."
Mm.
And when he sang that, I kind of stopped everything and said,
"That's the title."
Yeah, I think my search is over.
Yeah. Well, that explains why I didn't make the association between title and song, because I don't know a lot about Jason Isbell. The first two books, immediately, I knew where those titles had come from. So I'm glad to know that backstory.
The old lover's thing, I thought it'd be me who helped him get home. But home was a dream, one I'd never seen till you came.
Let's keep talking about music, because it serves as a powerful motif throughout the novel, offering the characters a source of solace, connection, and healing amidst adversity.
I knew, because of the role that music played in the first two stories, that it was going to be important once again. That's a theme that I think, as long as I'm writing about Tim Green, is going to be a piece of those stories. When I started thinking about a story about Bernie, it's pretty obvious. He's a music writer. This is a huge part of his life. But when I got back to Max, I knew music was going to play a role, but I didn't have a clear idea in my mind when I got started. Sort of the key there came in the research process, when I learned about how much music there had been at in Terezin and how important it was to the people who were imprisoned there, how much nourishment they got from that. And so I decided to give Max a musical instrument, and it had to be something that he could carry into Terezin. So it's a harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually presented a number of opportunities in terms of plot and in terms of character to bring that into the story. And then as he's in Terezin, he had a musical performance, gets interested in a girl, and then she starts taking piano lessons, and he says, as any 15 or 16-year-old boy might do, said, maybe I'll take piano lessons. And so it's a source of solace. It's a source of nourishment, as I said before, that helps him keep going. One of the things that has driven this and I'm sure contributed to some of those decisions I just described about how to frame the story, go back to my own grandfather, who was a musician.
Mm-hmm. Played the cello, didn't he?
He played the cello. I don't remember ever meeting him. I'm sure I met him at least once in my life, but he died when I was 9 years old and lived on the opposite coast from where I grew up. But that connection has played in my mind a lot as I've thought over the years about how important a role music plays in my life and how much I write about music, whether I'm writing nonfiction or fiction.
Yeah.
So to have that almost genetic pull toward music felt really natural to me.
There's a wonderful scene that's in Terezin when Max plays the harmonica for the boys in the barracks. And it's such a soothing moment for them, for those kids in this horrible situation. And, it's not the only time that music in the novel acts as a means of solace. Max had a violent tendency as a parent. And there's one scene where his son Bernie is getting a spanking to soothe himself during that ordeal. Bernie is thinking about blue suede shoes, thinking about Elvis. And then that's the way to kind of take him out of that terrible moment. So, yeah, music just permeates all three of these novels. It's very much a character in the series as a whole.
That tells me I achieved what I was going for then, because I really wanted it to be almost like another character in the novel. And one of the challenges this time was that my familiarity, my comfort zone is all in kind of 60s and 70s and later rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing a number of scenes that took place outside of that context. But it was kind of fun exploring that and thinking about what kind of music Max would have been exposed to and what kind of music would have been meaningful to him in that time period and what he would play on his harmonica.
Right.
And some research went into those choices. And there were a lot of musicians in Terezin who did a lot of composing as well as performing, which is equally remarkable. And the research that I went into there took me down some really interesting paths as well.
Are you going to do a playlist for this book, do you think?
I actually have already done that. And I'm planning, as probably around the time that this episode airs, that will be rolling out.
Great. I look forward to that. And I very much appreciate the Led Zeppelin shout out. I read the manuscript, not the book that has actually been published. So it was on page 25 of the manuscript. I noted that.
I couldn't talk about rock in 1970 and not mention Led Zeppelin.
Yep. Well done. Do you see this book, Home Was a Dream, as the final word on the Tim Green series or a continuation? Is there another one coming down the pike?
I will say that when I started each of the books in the series, I thought, well, I've said everything I need to say when I got to the end. And yet, I knew when I finished the first one that there was a piece of the story that I had left out about Tim's mother, because I didn't want to deal with that in the context of the first novel. When I got to the end of the second one, I was a little more realistic, and I tried to end it on a high note but also on a note that left the potential to continue the story. This time around, I feel like I've done something similar to Never Break the Chain, where I tried to leave on a high note, but leave territory that could be explored in another one. I will tell you that as I got into sort of the publishing piece of the process here, I told my wife, this is probably about 3 weeks ago, I said, you know, I'm not going to think about writing or what's next for the next few weeks, because I really need to focus on the rollout of the new book, and I can't really wear the creative hat and the publishing hat at the same time. So I made that pronouncement. And the next morning, I sat down at my computer and tapped out an entire page of notes on book four.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So all I could say is, what are you going to do?
Can you give any hints about, I know if you're just starting, you don't know where it's going to go, what it will eventually grow up to be, but any little tidbits you can give us about the focus?
I can give you a tiny bit.
Okay.
And that is that part of what got me thinking about it was I was reflecting on some of the challenges with writing Home Was a Dream and how difficult parts of it were, both to research and to write. And I was thinking, well, what would be fun to write about? What characters would you most enjoy writing more about? And so I gave myself that challenge, and I thought about two characters in particular. And then I realized that one of those characters features mostly in the first novel, and the other character features mostly in the second novel. And there isn't a super obvious or logical way to have their paths cross. So that, of course, means I have a challenge in front of me, and I accept the challenge.
Can I guess who you're talking about?
You're free to guess, but I don't think I'm going to answer.
All right, never mind. Don't tell me. But that's great. That's interesting that you're already starting to work on the fourth book. This series could just go on and on and on.
Can't get no rest. Don't know how I work all day. When will I learn? Memories get in the way. I walk around. I can't hear a sound, folks talking loud, but I don't see at all. I gotta get away, gotta get away.
So this is the point in the interview that I would normally introduce the Only Pick One game, which I've played with every rock novelist I've had on the show since the beginning of season two. It's just a fun game that gives everybody a giggle, but it occurred to me as I was preparing for this interview that such a big part of Home Was a Dream focuses on the atrocities the Jewish people faced during World War II, as we've discussed. And I didn't feel that the game has a place in this episode. So we're just going to skip it and just kind of wind up the combo here. So Jason, I wish you all the luck in the world for this book. And thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I have to say that one of the things I really enjoy about the sort of social media universe of independent authors is how supportive we are of each other. And I wish you all the success in the world, too.
Thank you very much.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live.
Find out more about Jason Warburg at his website, jasonwarburg.com, and at Jason_Warburg on Instagram, and at Jason Warburg on Twitter. Pick up a copy of Home Was a Dream and Jason's other Tim Green novels, Believe in Me and Never Break the Chain, at your local indie bookstore or wherever you buy books.
If you enjoyed this episode, Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I would sure appreciate a 5-star rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, keep rocking and reading and getting lit.
Rock is lit. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.